Betty bought a bit of butter, but the butter that Betty bought was spit.
Welcome to Dithering on the Edge of Europe, the podcast about what it feels like to be European and live in the UK. And I'm Carola Boom.
And I'm Rich McCarthy.
And today we're going to tackle another chapter in our European Charter.
Of fundamental rights.
At chapter 3, which is...
Equality.
Equality. But of course, the last chapters that we did was freedoms and dignity. And I just wanted to pause a second and just chat about why I think... this is so important. Why I'm so passionate about Europe, why I'm so passionate about the Charter.
Mm-hmm.
The strange thing is, these are basic human rights, aren't they? And they come also out of the European Convention for Basic Human Rights, to which we should all adhere to. I just didn't get why there was this resistance, also specifically in the UK in the past, to adopt something like the Charter, and even be against this notion of this ever closer union.
Yeah, it's like the Geneva Convention. You know, there should be, it was decided that there ought to be a kind of rules, even about warfare. We all go to that and we think it's despicable that some people don't apply by the Geneva Convention.
Well, exactly. And it means we can hold each other to account. You know, and I think, you know, what we've seen in Brexit UK is that there's a move to the right and the dignities and freedoms and our equality rights are under threat.
Yeah, and one thing maybe we ought to bear in mind, it's not just a little move to the right, it's a sort of massive shift to the right that's occurred in the last decade. You know, I think all the media owned by right wing, largely by individuals with lots of money who want what they want, you know, that really pushes things to the right. That's pushed Brexit, that's pushed the right wing in every country.
Exactly. And we hear politicians testing the waters on matters where I just thought nobody would go near that for, you know, gosh, forever. So we hear one of our MPs, our Conservative MPs, sort of suggesting abortion rights, you know, what his personal opinion about, which, you know, 12 weeks, that 12 weeks should be the limit for abortions. And if we think about some of the scandals that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, whether it's the Windrush scandal, whether it's the scandals in relation to the deportation centres. You know, the UK is the only country in the European Union which doesn't have limitations on detention. And in some ways, you know, when you read about those scandals, you know, you realise that we've made migrants criminals. So we automatically detain people who actually flee to Britain seeking protection. And, you know, there's something really, really wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know, with the Windrush scandal, it was people who've been here for years and years who didn't have a passport. You know, I've got one quote here of one of the individuals who was affected. And she says, "I was shocked when I was arrested and detained. I had been living a very nice life in the UK, working and paying my taxes, paying my health surcharge, paying my visa application fees. I didn't know very much about detention. I didn't know this world existed." And she was then detained and put into a detention centre. And some of the statistics suggest that 50% of people in detention centres in the end will be allowed legally to remain in the UK. So why go through this misery, you know?
So in the meanwhile, we've mentally damaged those
absolutely
people.
And, you know, if you remember, Panorama did an undercover program last year in Brookhouse, which is one of the detention centres.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the, you know, physical and verbally abuse which is happening there. I think the other things which struck me as well is that centres are exempt from the minimum wage, similar to prisons. So detainees can earn a wage, but a tiny wage. So it's almost like they're being detained against their will, and then they're allowed to, you know, to work in the kitchens for this tiny, tiny sub-minimal wage.
Yeah, less than your kid would want to get to be paid per hour to do for pocket money or something.
And when we look at, okay, so what are we doing about it? You know, this has been going on for the last 3 or 4 years, you know, so we see these scandals almost on a yearly basis in relation to our detention centers. And yes, actually, the number of individuals who are in those detention centers has reduced, but we still have one of the largest detention systems in Europe. But even MPs, so not the government, but MPs who are on the Home Affairs Committee, have actually explicitly found that they are, and I quote here, serious problems in almost every part of the detention system. And the report speaks of an institutional culture which prioritizes the use of detention as a means to enforce removal above respect, dignity, and the protection of vulnerable people. And then, of course, you get people, you know, coming through those detentions who just say, I feel like a criminal. You don't know what's happening to you. I don't know when I'm going to get out.
Yeah.
It's a prison under just a different name.
They don't need to be kept in effectively in prison. All that needs to happen is that somebody needs to keep an eye on where they are.
I think that would be a benign way of looking at it. I think it's much more sinister. It's not just about money. You know, Windrush didn't just happen about money.
Windrush wasn't, yeah.
You know, this is the far right asserting itself, and we've become normalized to that. And I think that's why this is important as well, because why is it that we're not up in arms about it? And I'm sympathetic to this notion of that we all sometimes have enough. You know, as individuals, we're beings. And when we look at our psychology and when we're under stress, we pull back. You know, if there's too much trauma in my life, then I will pull back from where the trauma is in order to protect myself. You know, that's a human reaction. And I think that reaction happens as a whole society as well. So we get, for instance, in the Brexit period, when we talk to various people that we know who are not really that politically inclined, and we talk, suddenly find ourselves talking about politics, they say, oh no, I don't deal with politics. I don't, you know, the moment I see Brexit in the newspapers, I just skip it. I can't, you know, I just don't want to hear it anymore. I've been talking about it enough. And it's almost like a national, what would you call it, a psyche, where the protection mechanism is to pull back.
Mm. Do you actually have that much? Because I haven't had that. I've had a couple of... Well, I've had one or two people say something like that, but then we just talk about it. And other than that, I've had members of my family who voted for Brexit, mm. who just want it to happen. And other than that...
Yeah, and as we said before, the media always
I think
says,
maybe the people who voted for Brexit just want it to happen and just yeah. get on with it and so on.
Well, you know, as we've talked before, the media always suggests nobody wants to talk about Brexit anymore. And actually, you know, there is also on the other side a big appetite. Yeah, you know, we need to talk. Maybe yeah. we don't want to talk, but we need to talk. And yes, I have encountered that we start talking over lunch and then somebody says, oh, no, you know, at home, I just don't talk about politics. And I think partially it is about gently pushing through that and saying, well, we are in that situation where we are. You know, we'll you know, if we don't talk about politics, we'll find ourselves in a well, situation where we don't want to
we
be.
We are in this situation that we're in because we don't talk about politics. And if we talked about politics, perhaps our political situation would be a lot better. We wouldn't yeah. have got into this mess.
Yeah, but I can understand that psychological protection mechanism that makes us pull back from the pain and the anxiety
from talking, yeah.
and from talking. And that happens at a society level. And we call that normalization. But I think it's rather a protection mechanism where we collectively sometimes say, I just don't want to hear this anymore.
Yeah, isn't normalization is a different thing. Normalization, I think, isn't normalization where you hear something and it's shocking and then you hear it again and it's shocking. You hear it the third time, it's, oh yeah, I've heard that a couple of other times. Then you hear it another time, you go, yeah, well, that's normal.
Yeah, but I think it is the same thing. You could argue that that person where you say who is being normalized, every time something like that is happening, that person is actually pulling back.
Well, I think normalization, though, means that you'd start talking about something that would have shocked you before you were normalized, and now you talk about it as though it's normal. And
yeah.
that's not... normalization is and I can understand that when you're not normalized might lead to you wanting to just say no, I don't want to talk about that, thanks.
It's both processes, isn't it? You know, there's on the one hand normalization, but there's also this pulling back. But I think we don't recognize enough that as a society, you know, there's a psychology at work which is very dangerous because it allows far extreme right people to come forward. So if I now bring in sort of the German part of history, you know, as a German here in Britain, in Brexity Britain, I'm constantly very much aware of and anxious of the possibility that we move further right. And that at some point, you know, we have these detention centers where the human dignity and human rights are being undermined. We have politicians who do not want to support the Charter of Basic Human Rights. So I can see that if then both normalization and this pulling back from engaging in these issues happens, that politicians like that could come to the fore. And I'm pretty sure that that's how, you know, the Nazi regime happened. And it's difficult to make comparison, but, you know, when our basic human rights are visibly under threat, and when we have such a fabulous document like the Charter in front of us, which has been created in order for various nations to hold each other to account, then I can only see that as a positive thing.
Yeah, because we all fall and we all slip and we all have doubts. But if you have something saying, no, it can't go below this, it can't go below that, it can't go below this other thing, then every time you come below that, you just say, oh, no, I can't do that because of so-and-so. Like when we were, when our son was younger and we wanted to watch, he wanted to get videos, and we did manage to get him into the idea that he couldn't watch anything that was older than a 12 because he wasn't 15 yet. And he'd say, oh, look, there's this. And it was great because we were going to the library to get videos out, and he'd go, oh, but it's a, oh, never mind, it's a 15. Yeah. And he just put it away. He didn't try and bug us about it or annoy us. He just said, okay, I'm not allowed to watch that. I can't watch that. And if you have those sort of boundaries in politics as well and in life, it makes everything easier.
I think so. And I think there's also something else. On the one hand, yes, they work as boundaries, but on the other hand, they are an expression of the type of society that we aspire to.
Yeah, that we actually want.
That's why we are fighting the political, you know, ideological struggles.
Yeah, that we are. Mayhem of people who want to say, oh, just do it my way and I will win this for us and that for us. Doesn't matter if I break the rules a bit. We don't want you to break the rules. Exactly. We don't want to break the rules. We just want to get on and have a happy life. And we want other people to have happy lives as well. And in order to do that, we stick by the rules.
Yeah. If we break the rules, which are our basic fundamental expressions of human dignity and rights, if we break that, to what end, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of bad things. A, you become the people you don't want to be. But the other thing is, if we start breaking the rules, what's to stop everybody else from breaking the rules? And when everybody else breaks the rules, there's going to be somebody who can break the rules better than we can. Yeah. And they'll undercut us and do the nasty on us and do the dirty on us. And we'll have no recourse because we've been breaking the rules too. Mm. So, and then you just say, oh, well, okay, you beat me. Mm. But by the time that has happened, life is really rubbish for everybody.
And of course, it's a difficult field, especially detention centers in a time where immigration numbers are really high. I know that we've discussed before that we actually believe in much more open borders. You know, it would actually resolve some of the struggles because people would go and come much more easily. And actually, we do want to have more people working here. You know, there are jobs here that need to be done.
Yeah, but people on the right, 3 years ago, between about 8, 9 years ago, 10 years ago, and up until the Brexit vote, pretty well, they would argue black and blue that, you know, the reason that people's jobs were low paid, it wasn't because people just got away with paying everybody as little as they possibly could instead of sticking to a minimum wage or instead of having a higher minimum wage. The fault was it wasn't the fault of the people employing people. No, it was the fault of the people being the migrants coming in to take that low-paid work.
You know, I think we need a charter like this to hold each other to account in a union, you know, of nations where we subscribe to adhering to fundamental human rights and dignities.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in a country like UK, which is moving to the right, you know, we could do with being held to account a bit more.
Well, yeah, but every country needs it. That's the whole point. Also, there's a mention in here that first first paragraph. Is it the first paragraph or it's in the preamble? The peoples of Europe in creating an ever closer union among them. And I know that people in my family have worried about this ever closer union. Well, it's either we're getting closer or we're getting further apart. You never stay right on the same equidistant. And the whole point of getting closer and closer was to prevent war. Because the countries of Europe were some of the most populated countries in the world, and they're the most developed and advanced, in inverted commas, sort of technologically advanced and warfare advanced. And so we created world wars. And to stop that, the whole point of Europe was to get close together, to bond, to tie people together with, or tie nations together with trade and with agreements and with people visiting each other and stuff like that. And that's all worked really well. We haven't had those wars. And we've had occasions where we've had a bit of a barney with the French fairly recently. From Britain and France did a little bit, the fishing vessels did. But it could be talked about and not break out and turned into warfare.
Yeah. You know, if you think about, you know, again, the notion of which this charter is founded, you know, on universal values of human dignity, freedom, equality and solidarity, you would actually realize you want to sign up to that. But of course, a government which might have intentionally created situations like Windrush really sees itself in tension with these values.
Yeah, maybe so. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I suppose the trouble is, from their point of view, if you have those values, then you have to pay people decent wages, etc., instead of paying them as little as you possibly can. Because if you can pay them as little as possibly can, then you personally can make a profit, or a higher profit.
But if our politicians are not the representatives who aspire to, you know, the basic human values and rights, you know, who is?
Yeah. And well, the trouble is, they're not. They're not representing the typical people of Britain.
Yeah, as we know. They
seem to be only representing the very wealthy people in Britain.
Mm. Right, so we're going to look at the charter.
Okay.
Right, so we are on chapter 3, equality.
That's a little plug for remaining, charter. I suppose.
Yes, and it's a plug for the charter that I think we all can be proud of. So the first article of the chapter 3, equality, is just equality before the law, which is very short. Everyone is equal before the law.
Yes, and I've got Donald Trump exclamation mark written below that.
Yeah, there is a sort of other interesting perspective that I think one of the critiques that the British government had in relation to the charter is that it mixes principles with rights. And so everyone is equal before the law. You could argue, is that a principle or is that a right? But to be honest, you know, I'm not sure if I care, you know. This is our philosophy and basic ideology of the rights of every human being in the European Union. So whether that's a principle or a right, you know, it's
both, really. Okay, so the next thing is non-discrimination, which is Article 21. So 1 says, any discrimination based on any ground, such as sex, race, colour, ethnic or social origin, genetic features, language, religion or belief, political or any other opinion, that's a big thing, membership of a national minority, property, birth, disability, age, or sexual orientation shall be prohibited.
Second article there is within the scope of application of the treaty establishing the European Community and of the Treaty on European Union, and without prejudice to the special provisions of those treaties, any discrimination on grounds of nationality shall be prohibited. And that discrimination on grounds of nationality is an interesting one because, of course, as you know, we have differential fees for higher education here in the UK. And also we're one of the only European countries which has such a substantial higher education fee.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we've got £9,200 per...
Pretty well for every university per year.
Yeah, and German's education is still free, except there's a sort of student fee of something like £300 per year, you know, which pays for the student union and stuff like that.
Right, okay.
So it's much, much smaller. But not only are we one of the only countries in the European Union which has fees, within our United Kingdom, of course, we have Scotland, where students do not pay the fee, where the government, the Scottish government, pays
the
higher education. And of course, we have the Welsh system, where the Welsh government even pays Welsh students to study in England if they go to England.
Okay, right.
But this differential fees, you know, because what was interesting is that you kind of think, well, how can they do that in terms of non-discrimination? Because you're basically saying, okay, so you're from, you know, for instance, Glasgow University, you know, they would say, okay, so you're an English student, you have to pay fees. You're a Scottish student, you don't have to pay fee. So that would be discrimination according to nationality. However, of course, the legal loophole is that they do it on the basis of residency. So it's not about you being a Scottish citizen or an English citizen. It is about you being a resident in Scotland or a resident in England.
Yeah. Right. So it all gets very difficult.
Yeah, and if you take, for instance, the extreme, so you take overseas students versus UK students, the fee differential is immense. Is it because there's a different offer? No, it's simply because they're overseas. International undergraduate tuition fees vary considerably. So if you take, for instance, just the first ones on the list, so Anglia Ruskin for normal overseas classroom, you know, 12,500 to 14,500, whereas lab-based courses goes all the way up to 21,000. Birmingham University, for instance, for normal courses, 15,000 to lab-based ones to 20,000, and then clinical up to 36,000. And if you take Cambridge, clinical goes all the way up to 58,000, but the cheapest undergraduate fee for just normal undergraduate overseas students is 27,000. So that's three times the
normal amount.
The normal amount. Then you can ask yourself, so why? Obviously, the market has accepted this as well, but in some ways, in terms of discrimination, you could ask, are they getting something different? No, they're just being discriminated against on the basis of that the market can take that.
Yeah,
you know, that's the neoliberal model. And of course, we know that marketization crept into higher education as well. And like some people have said, you know, university degrees, it's a prestige economy. So you pay not for the quality of your teaching and learning. You pay for the prestige element as well of the degree that you're getting.
Article 22 is cultural, religious and linguistic diversity. The union shall respect cultural, religious and linguistic diversity. So, and that's very good. We've got healthy Welsh language these days, I believe, in Wales, which is superb for all those people who can speak it. I wish I could speak it. I should know how to speak it because I went to Aberystwyth for 3 years, but I was below par when I went to Aberystwyth and didn't learn the local language at all, unfortunately.
I saw that pop up on the BBC news that in Finland there has been a 30-year-long running News in Latin program.
Wow.
Which just recently stopped.
Did the person die or something?
And I think it's a shame.
It's like they finally popped their clogs at 90 or something.
No. I think it was just an academic team which started News in Latin, has been running since 1989. And I think they've just said, look, We know that this news in Latin, Nuntii Latini, will be missed around the world and will send warm regards to our 500 listeners. But they had, you know, they had a very heavily engaging 500 to 800 Latin enthusiasts who not only tuned in, but regularly engaged in that. So that's actually, you know, isn't that lovely, you know, in terms of language, linguistic diversity. And of course, where it's also really important, the union shall respect cultural, religious and linguistic diversity. If we, you know, if we just think back in terms of our history in Britain, that there were times where Gaelic was not allowed to be spoken, but now it's being supported. And of course, you know, they are part of Wales and part of Scotland, where you're still being taught Gaelic,
different types of Gaelic.
Absolutely, yes.
So I think the Scottish Gaelic isn't doing so well, but the Welsh is. The Welsh is.
Yeah, but the Welsh have always been very, very good in language, haven't they? You know, it's.
Yeah, but I think it's partly because it has been supported nationally. So they've said, you know, all road signs are half in Welsh and half in English, and most things to do with government are provided in Welsh as well as being provided in English. Or maybe now we should be saying they're provided in English as well as being provided in Welsh.
Yeah, but Scotland also has road signs in Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, as well as English. But yeah, I think you're right, you know, that if you, for instance, are employed by a Welsh university, I think you have to have a commitment to at least learn Welsh. Mm-hmm. And there might be Welsh lectures.
Which seems fair enough. I mean, people would say the same thing about if you came and studied in, came and worked at an English university. Oh, if you don't speak English, you'd have to be learning it.
But I think, you know, there are sort of historic developments where there was more pressure in Scotland to not speak Scottish because of Bonnie Prince Charles, who, you know, wants to...
keeping down the Scots, basically.
Keeping down the Scots, exactly. So that's cultural, religious and linguistic diversity. And of course, in Article 23 is equality between men and women.
Oh, yes. Equality between men and women must be ensured in all areas, including employment, work and pay. Mm. So I think...
The principle of equality shall not prevent the maintenance or adoption of measures providing for specific advantages in favour of the underrepresented sex.
Yeah, it's good that they've got that there because it's ready for when women are on top.
That's
so to speak.
Right.
And when women are the dominating part of our society.
So we don't get to disadvantage you lot when we finally come to power.
Absolutely, yes.
Right, and then
leather and the whips I can take, but the disadvantageousness is a bit more tricky. But I wanted to mention, I wanted to go back a little bit to work and pay. Look at the figures, some of the figures that we've got. According to The Guardian, almost 8 in 10 companies pay men more than women. 3,010 of the 10,014 who had signed up to this equal pay, this look at equal pay, had a pay gap higher than the national median, which is 18.4%. So that's about a fifth of a difference between the pay to men and women. And this is 8 years after we had a law passed saying that men and women should be paid equal amounts for equal work.
And I think, you know, that's why we also need the European Union to hold us to account of fair pay for fair working conditions. And I think that's the next chapter, you know, not this chapter.
That seems to be the biggest reason why the UK doesn't want to be in the EU, why the leavers want to leave. It's so that we can become more, what's the word, more...
exploitative.
That's not the word they use, but that's actually what they mean.
Absolutely.
They say we want to be more, not competitive, but more productive. What they really mean is we want to be able to pay people less and less and less so our products can get cheaper and cheaper while we still keep paying the top guys, well, as we see, it's mainly top guys, more and more money.
And it's about paying workers less, but continue to pay the owners more.
Yeah. And the whole thing is if the more we may remain in the EU, the less likely that is to happen.
Absolutely. So the other articles, which we're not going to go into, but of course there are the Article 24, the rights of the child, Article 25, the rights of the elderly, and Article 26, the last one in this chapter, is integration of persons with disabilities.
Yeah.
And that's this chapter.
Yeah, okay, well, we blitzed over those last few, but...
Right. But we don't have so much to say. So...
Yeah. Well, we could have, but we don't want to make this incredibly long, so...
I know. I think we should leave it as that.
Okay.
I think, you know, the more I look into the charter, the more, yes, I want to sign up to it. Where's the place where I can sign up on it?
It
can only
be
a good thing, you know. Yeah. And I should actually also note...
Certainly, we weren't really aware of the charter when it came out. That's us. Maybe that's just us. Perhaps the whole of the rest of the population were all onto it, all knew about it,
Absolutely.
All thought it's a good thing or a bad thing, made up their own minds, read it.
Yeah. And it's a lovely, as we said, it's a lovely writing. And there is an app, so you can look up the EU Charter on your smartphone.
Where do we go for the app? Or what is the app?
So the app is just the charter. So all of the articles are there, so you can download it. So it's got handy explanations of each of the articles.
Mm-hmm.
It's just called EU Charter.
Okay, so on any app store, So it's a brilliant app if you're a lawyer or if you're a person affected by things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fantastic app to have.
No, I think so. Then they were initially looking into how can we raise awareness of the charter when it was finally created in 2009, or it came into being in 2009. They were wanting to commission a poetic composition based on the articles of the EU Charter, 80 minutes in length.
So 80?
It's wow. An opera. It's a charter opera. It should be a group performance that reflects the diversity of the EU. And the performance itself need not be limited to just English and indeed is encouraged to include other official languages of the EU. So that was the proposition, but it was turned down on the matter of cost. It was perceived to be something too luxurious. But maybe the call comes out to all our poets and musicians. You know, it doesn't have to be 80 minutes. It could be just 5 minutes if we could have some compositions on the basis of the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Right. If you've enjoyed the show, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, because it helps others to find us.
Yep.
Feel free to follow us on Twitter, on Dithering on the Edge, at DitheringE. Goodbye for now.
Yeah, goodbye everybody.
And have a fabulous week.
Right then. Bye. That's what podcasts are all about, baby.